reminded of the Maori elders and their belief that trauma, anxiety, depression, and substance abuse are all the same thing, and all related to our connectedness, our sense of belonging.
I agree. I mentioned that. One profound thing I realized after listening to thousands of people share their stories is that all pain is the same. We just choose different ways to express it. And beyond that, I believe we're all here to learn from one another's pain. So the loss of community and the social isolation we all feel is a source of great collective pain.
Exactly. Disconnection is disease. I think the Maori elders were right in that there is some correlation between rising suicide rates and the increased fraying of our social fabric. We're now raising our children and youth in environments that are both relationally impoverished and sensory overloading from the proliferation of screen-based technologies.
We're all too attached to our phones. No one even makes eye contact.
Right. There's more texting, tweeting, and posting, but less actual conversation. I believe we don't have enough quiet conversational moments, listening to a friend with no other distractions. That kind of interaction leads to a completely different quality of human connection, a different depth. I think we crave that, and many of us turn to social media to find it, but ultimately those interactions don't satisfy the craving. Meanwhile, rates of suicide, anxiety, and depression are rising in our youth. We think of our culture as so advanced, and we have such wealth, creativity, and productivity, yet the disparities and inequities in all of our systems continue to marginalize, fragment, and undermine community and cultural cohesion. We may have a pretty good public education system. We may have amazing technologies, but we're still not meeting the fundamental relational needs of our children or ourselves. So many people feel empty and are seeking connection, and often seeking it in really unhealthy ways.
And it happens at all socioeconomic levels. Wealth doesn't seem to stop anyone from having anxiety or depression.
True. But being on the bottom of any power differential makes life a lot harder. If you don't belong to the in-group, your marginalization can contribute to feelings of not belonging. As we talked about earlier, the brain is continually scanning the social environment for signals that tell you if you do or don't belong. When a person gets the signals, many of which are subconscious, that they belong, their stress response systems quiet down, telling them they're safe. They feel regulated and rewarded. But when they get cues that they don't belong, their stress response systems are activated. And don't belong cues are our default response to anyone we don't know, especially if they don't have the attributes of our familiar group. We view this person as a potential threat.
As the other.
That's right. Now think about the implications of that for our modern world. As we mentioned, if you live in an urban area, you may see hundreds of new people every day, and your brain has to continually monitor these hundreds of people. Friend or foe, help me or hurt me. It is taxing. It consumes emotional bandwidth. Often people living in urban settings learn to completely ignore and disengage with others. They may walk past you without any acknowledgement. The interaction makes you feel invisible, but for them it might just be a form of self-preservation. Many people have had the experience of feeling exhausted after a day of travel, even if all they did was stand in a few lines and sit on a plane. This happens because your brain was continuously monitoring thousands of new stimuli. Remember, activating your stress response systems, even at a moderate level, for long periods of time is physically and emotionally exhausting. So part of the increase in anxiety in our modern world comes down to the constant bombardment of novelty, especially social novelty, and the absence of counterbalancing relational connection.
So, as our world expands and we encounter more and more people, the brain becomes overwhelmed.
Exactly. And as a result, it will start to use shortcuts to manage all of these new people. Your brain can manage only a limited number of fully reciprocal relationships. Interestingly, in light of what we've been talking about, this number is about 80 to 100 people. The size of a large hunter-gatherer band.
It takes a lot of energy and time to get to know someone new, and there's only so much space in our brains. Maybe this is why moving is so hard.
Right. When you're new to a community, having moved away from what's familiar, your brain is going to be continually trying to manage all the novelty. And that's very hard to do without any real relational anchors in the new environment. The relationships will grow, but it takes time. This is why people are most vulnerable in the first 6 months after major transitions, after leaving the safe, stable, and known behind to start building a new set of connections. Think of the girls at your school. They are incredible young women, but they've been taken out of their social context and put into a completely new environment. Until they can rebuild that connectedness, there's a vulnerability.
That's why I try to find them host families so they always have a place to go, a safe space.
And that's a really smart thing to do because connectedness is what helps us manage transitions and regulate in the face of nonstop bombardment of novelty.
And now, without community, what do people do? They look to their devices. There's nothing objectively wrong with it, but in the end, it's a hollow connection.
Exactly. I sometimes see an almost frenetic attempt to be connected by getting more friends or followers or likes. There's such a powerful pull to belong, to make your clan. But as you say, social media connections are often hollow.
Because it's not the friends or followers who stay by your side when you're sick or when you get divorced or just feel lonely. They're not sitting at the table with their neighbors or even in many cases with their families. I'm thinking back to what you said earlier, that disconnection is disease. Could isolation be categorized as a new form of trauma?
Well, I do think that in some situations, isolation and loneliness can create sensitization of the stress response systems. So in that way, they can be traumatic. For example, putting someone in solitary confinement. The timing of the isolation also makes a difference. Think of the woman I met with in prison who'd been abandoned as a newborn. I think it would certainly be reasonable to consider relational poverty, lack of connectedness, as an adversity. Poverty of relationship can disrupt normal development, influence how the brain works, put you at risk for physical and mental health problems. It's absolutely not good for you.
Especially for children.
Yes. We all want to be part of a group, yet so many children are marginalized, excluded, or bullied. This can be devastating. Being left out can have a deep and enduring impact. In many ways, the result of our society's poverty of relationships is a form of social and emotional starvation. Our children are starving.
I think that's a difficult concept for most people to get because children in our modern culture seem to have everything. What do you mean when you say they're starving?
Well, there are different forms of nourishment. One of the things we don't appreciate in Western cultures is how powerful and important touch is to our physical and emotional growth. Touch is as essential for healthy physical and emotional development as calories and vitamins. If infants aren't held or rocked, if they don't experience the loving warmth of a caregiver's touch, they won't grow. In fact, they can die.
Literally die?
Absolutely. And many people in our society, including children and youth, are touch starved. Healthy touch is not well understood. We actually have schools where tiny toddlers whose impulse is to run up and hug a classmate or teacher are told not to touch. In return, the teachers and other caregivers are not allowed to touch the children. But it's simply unhealthy for a 3 or 4 year old child to go 8 hours without touching or hugging or playfully wrestling with another person.
That's one of the things that so disturbed me when I heard about parents being separated from their children at the Mexico-U.S. border. Colleen Kraft, the former head of the American Academy of Pediatrics, said what struck her was that the caretakers weren't allowed to touch the toddlers. The babies are screaming and crying, and the caretakers have been told that they're not allowed to touch them. They just kept giving them toys and giving them toys and giving them toys. I know there's a way to allow healthy touch while protecting children from unwanted touch.
Absolutely there is. This is a classic example of making policy recommendations with good intentions but minimal understanding of the developmental needs of children. The intent is to help children by minimizing the potential for inappropriate touch or abuse, and at the same time, protect staff from any false allegations. But rather than thinking through reasonable options to ensure healthy touch in a well-monitored setting, blanket no-touch rules are applied. This is a common thread in our culture. we're reactive. We prioritize convenient short-term solutions. We're risk-averse, and we use material things rather than relationships as rewards. Here, have a toy. Be good, and we'll give you a thing. Giving toys instead of calming touch is an outrageously misguided practice. It's the result of developmentally ignorant, trauma-uninformed policies, and another example of the need to change our systems.
When I heard that, it made me cry. We really need to do better. We know better. We know that human contact is healthy. We know that too much time in front of a screen cannot replace a friend, a teacher, coach, or parent.
And again, the speed with which we're inventing our world is outpacing our ability to understand the impact of our inventions. Television, video games, phones, computers, these are all pretty new. And we don't quite know the full impact of these devices on the developing brain, on how our children will think and process experience. But we're beginning to understand the disruptive impact that 11 hours in front of a screen can have on social development. We've all seen the disruptive effect of text messages or phone calls during a family dinner or a conversation with friends. And the distracting impact of surfing the internet during a lecture in school or a meeting at work.
I've heard you use the phrase techno-hygiene. I love that. Will you explain what it means?
Basically, I believe we need to develop social practice rules about when and how to use our new technologies. We've always invented new rules as we've created new technologies. Take current hygiene practices, for example. In the history of medicine, one of the most important advances was recognizing the relationships among disease, microbes, and sewage. It seems unbelievable to us now, but surgeons used to go into surgery without washing their hands. People went to the bathroom wherever they wanted, and communities dumped sewage into drinking water sources. But as we learned about bacteria, infection, and disease, we realized we needed to manage things better. A host of hygiene protocols developed. We socialized children to go to the bathroom in the bathroom. We wash our hands after using the toilet. We keep our sewage away from our drinking water. I think we need the same sort of universal rules for the standard use of our technologies. No phone zones and no phone times. Proper dosing and spacing of screen time and so forth. We know, for example, that nonstop screen time for a young child is not optimal for healthy development of language skills, attention, or concentration. So age and time limit recommendations have been made by the American Academy of Pediatrics. As we learn more, we can develop and modify some of these hygiene recommendations.
Isn't it true that children who are under the age of 2 or 3 should not even be looking at a tablet or screen because it's bad for the development of the brain?
It's probably not optimal.
Why is that?
Well, our brain is organized in a way that makes us visually biased. Though we have multiple senses, vision tends to be the dominant one. Images can evoke powerful responses because our brain has a preference for colorful and moving visual content. When you combine those two things on a screen, the viewer's attention is captured. That's not necessarily bad until it becomes so pleasing and engaging to the brain that we begin to prefer it to other less stimulating, less busy sensory input. An infant or toddler consumed by a screen is missing out on other critical forms of learning about the world. They should be exploring what things feel like, smell like, taste like. They should be making sense of their world using all their sensory tools. You know how babies and toddlers are always putting things in their mouth? They're trying to see what a purple flower tastes like. They are making sense of the world. But if 75% of your day is spent staring at a screen, not touching, feeling, moving, or interacting with other human beings, you're essentially underdeveloping key parts of the brain that are rapidly organizing at that time of life. The best way to teach a child language isn't to put them in front of a screen. It's to talk with them. When you actually look at children's language acquisition, you see that fluency is related to the number of words spoken in a back-and-forth, interactive, conversational way, not the number of words heard on a device.
And we want children to make real-life connections with other children and adults. As you said, the empathy systems in the brain develop when there are many opportunities for stimulation.
So, ideally, If a child is growing up in a relationally wealthy home with lots of opportunities for safe, stable, and nurturing interactions, they will be building their connectedness and resilience. This insight was a core understanding of all the traditional child-rearing and healing practices I learned about from Indigenous elders. Their understanding of the primacy of human connectedness reflects a wisdom lost in our current world. How ironic that the cultures our modern world has marginalized are the very cultures with the wisdom to heal our modern woes.
Chapter 10, What We Need Now. Years ago, I played the character of Setha in the film version of Toni Morrison's searing novel, Beloved. Setha was a former slave, haunted by the horrific death of her daughter, Beloved. In the film, Beloved returns to Setha, reincarnated as a disabled child Setha takes into her home. For the rest of her life, Setha does penance to Beloved as their relationship becomes more and more debilitating and intertwined. One day, we were shooting a scene where Setha was supposed to tuck Beloved into bed. The only instruction I got from the director, Jonathan Demme, was, "Okay, tuck her in. Action." And so I walked to each corner of the bed and folded the blanket down perfectly and tucked it under the mattress. "Cut!" Jonathan yelled from behind the camera. "Oprah, you're not tucking her in." And so I repeated the process more purposefully, tucking each corner of the blanket under the mattress. "Cut!" Jonathan walked over to me. "What are you doing?" he said. "I'm tucking her in." I could feel a mix of fear and embarrassment rising inside me, but I didn't know why. "You're making the bed," he said, "not tucking in your daughter for bed." In that moment, something clicked deeply. I stared at Jonathan. "I don't know what tucking in means," I said quietly. "I don't know how to do that." Finally, we both understood what was happening. Jonathan gently taught me how to circle my daughter with loving tucks of the blanket. As we moved around the bed together, I was hit by a flood of grief. I don't recall ever being tucked in. I never felt anyone place a blanket on me with that kind of loving intention. "That must be what a mother's love is," I thought. Years later, I was in the kitchen with my friend Urania and her young daughter Kylie. Urania asked Kylie if she'd like something to eat. "Yes, please," Kylie said. Urania went to the refrigerator and took out some strawberries. She washed them, took a knife, and began slicing. I could see she'd done this many times before. As the knife moved around the berry, the shape of a delicate rose began to emerge. "A strawberry rose," I marveled. Urania carefully placed the beautiful berries on a plate and handed them to her daughter. Watching, my eyes filled with tears. The tenderness with which she did it seared my soul. Again, I said to myself, "That must be what a mother's love is." My mother and I had a complicated relationship, as I mentioned earlier. I spent my early childhood, my first 6 years, living with my grandmother. I have no memory of my mother during that period. When my grandmother became sick, I was suddenly moved to Milwaukee to live with my mother. This was not a joyful maternal child reunion. I could feel I was not welcome. The night I arrived in Milwaukee, the woman my mother was boarding with, Mrs. Miller, took one look at me and said, "She'll have to sleep on the porch." Ms. Miller was light-skinned. She could almost pass for white, and she was not going to have this nappy-headed dark child, as she said, stay in the house. My mother said, "All right." I had never slept anywhere but in my grandmother's bed. On the enclosed porch, I could hear noise from the street. As I watched my mother close the house door to go to the bed where I thought I'd sleep, I was consumed with a terrified sense of loneliness that brought me to tears. I imagined a robber snatching me from the porch or someone breaking through the windows and choking me. That first night, I got on my knees and prayed to God to please send angels to protect me. When I woke in the morning, the terror was gone, but the sense of being unsafe while sleeping would remain for much of my life. A knowing had filled my soul. At 6 years old, I felt I was alone and no one but God was going to watch out for me. My pain and the resolve that followed it became a cycle that would repeat itself many times. I believe it is, in a profound way, the very through line of my life. The struggles I endured as a child are what allowed me to recognize and care about pain in others. The validation I longed for as a child is what I see other people longing for just as intensely. Thousands of people had the courage to share their stories with me because their story was my story. Their pain was my pain. Because all pain is the same. Oprah. There's so many beautiful stories of people who say they were able to break the cycle of abuse or trauma in their family. Is it possible to completely prevent passing on the negative or toxic effects of such experiences?
Well, it's important to clarify that most people who are abused don't go on to abuse others in the same way. On the other hand, it is becoming clear that it's the very rare person who's been abused who doesn't have some form of adaptation that impacts how they deal with people. It doesn't have to be a pathology, but it can influence the ways in which you form and maintain relationships. This goes back to our earlier talk about why some people seem to seek abusive relationships. Our brain, our mind, pulls us toward familiar patterns, even when those patterns are negative. People end up repeating previous maladaptive patterns and often don't recognize it. A lot of times, the people around us will see it more clearly than we do.
Yes, and so often, real change can't happen until you do see it for yourself. I knew very early on in my childhood that if I was going to make it, I was going to have to do it on my own. There was no scaffolding, as you call it, built for me. But over the years, there were some very special teachers who took the time to nurture the potential they recognized in me. And that's what you're saying. It really can be just a handful of people seeing you through a new lens and taking time to help. My teachers didn't have a trauma-informed education. Now that some people have, and now that your groundbreaking work is out in the world making ripple effects, are you hopeful that more people can heal?
I'm more hopeful than I was 20 years ago. I've spent most of my career trying to better understand and help children, youth, and adults after trauma. For us, a major advancement came when we could finally translate some of the complex neuroscience into useful models for clinical work. The neurosequential model allows us to create a version of how the individual's brain appears to be organized. It is basically like an inspection of a house. By asking about the history of the house's construction, the what happened to you, we're able to hone in on the most likely problems. What would predictably happen if you don't let the cement on the foundation set, or didn't properly route the plumbing up to the second floor? Once we know the source of the problem, we can better understand how to fix it. In a sequence that replicates the original construction of the house, the brain, we put in place a rebuilding/renovation plan. With the problem areas in mind, we can provide experiences, both educational and therapeutic, that jumpstart and reorganize the systems that were impacted by neglect, adversity, and trauma. we have a better idea about how to select and sequence therapeutic experiences, a better grasp of what we can do to help and when. We have a lot more to learn, but we're pretty optimistic. Hundreds of thousands of children, youth, and adults from over 26 countries have benefited from clinical and educational services that use this neurodevelopmental trauma-aware lens. Think back to Mike Roseman. When we finally started the bottom-up approach that helped regulate his trauma-sensitized core regulatory networks, that was a beta version of the neurosequential model approach, addressing the brain's problems in the proper sequence and focusing on the lower networks before moving on to issues in the higher regions.
Regulate, relate, then reason, as you say.
Exactly. Let me give you one additional, even more detailed example of how this works. About 20 years ago, we were asked to see Susan, a 7-year-old girl who'd been adopted at age 2. Her behaviors were overwhelming her parents, teachers, and therapists. At age 2, when she was adopted, Susan was nonverbal and had sleep problems, prolonged temper tantrums, staring spells, and self-mutilation behaviors like scratching her face and picking at her skin until it bled. As she got older, physical and occupational therapists, tutors, live-in mental health specialists, in-school aides, developmental pediatricians, psychologists, and psychiatrists were involved in her care. She'd been through 5 years of shifting diagnostic labels and treatments, with minimal progress. Earlier in her life, Susan had profound adversity and minimal relational connection. The foundation of her house was very likely weak and fragile. She was born to a single mother who struggled with mental health problems. The mother had been removed from her own parents when she was 4 and spent her entire childhood and youth in a series of foster homes. At 18, she aged out of the system and was on her own. She immediately became pregnant but was unable to care for Susan. The child welfare system removed Susan at 4 months of age and ultimately terminated parental rights. Susan became a ward of the state. This form of transgenerational trauma is not uncommon with so many of the children in our child protective systems. When Susan was removed from her mother, she entered shelter care for 2 months. Then she was in a succession of 3 foster homes before she was finally adopted. One can only imagine her worldview about the safety and trustworthiness of adults. The process of building her house was continually interrupted. The wiring, plumbing, and framing were all impacted by a 2-year span of unpredictable, uncontrollable, and extreme activation of her stress response systems. It was no surprise that she had classic symptoms of a sensitized dissociative system. Her self-mutilation, as we have talked about before, was an attempt to regulate herself. In the face of unavoidable pain and distress, she dissociated, hence her staring spells. And the arousal component of her stress response was also sensitized. Her temper tantrums were the toddler's equivalent of the fight-or-flight response. This was a terrified, confused, undeveloped child. Now, part of the problem was that the educational and mental health systems, not to mention her parents, viewed Susan as a 7-year-old child. But while she was chronologically 7, she wasn't developmentally 7. She had the social skills of an infant, the regulatory skills of a 2-year-old, the cognitive skills of a 3-year-old. Parents, teachers, and therapists kept trying to reason with her. They explained the rules and tried to explore why she did all those naughty things. They were doing the best they could. They did not understand state-dependent functioning or the developmental challenges that were predictable considering Susan's history. Our neurosequential model allowed us to create a blueprint for therapeutics that started with the foundation, the bottom parts of Susan's brain. She had significant sensory integration issues. She couldn't stand being touched. When more than one person was talking in a room, she was overwhelmed. She wouldn't tolerate certain fabrics on her skin. She was always burying herself beneath piles of pillows and blankets and more. So we started by creating a set of predictable and patterned somatosensory experiences. Weighted blankets, gradually introduced therapeutic massage, an enriched sensory diet provided by a trauma-aware occupational therapist. we didn't focus on Susan's problems with peers, her inability to pay attention in class, her depressive symptoms, her explosive outbursts, or even her speech problems. We were going in sequence. We started with the lower systems, knowing we'd get to the other problems later in the treatment process. A key part of the neurosequential approach is to help parents, teachers, and clinicians know the stage and watch the state. Meaning, we want to help them learn what the child's actual developmental capabilities are, their actual stage, as opposed to their age. And we want to help them become aware of the child's state dependence. We encourage them to ask themselves, is this child in a state where they can effectively hear what I'm trying to say or teach? It's amazing how often we ignore this. As we have discussed, if a child is too dysregulated, they will not be open to any new learning or experience. And if you continue to expect the child to pay attention, focus, and learn, you'll be eroding the child's sense of safety with you. You'll be damaging the empathic bond between the two of you, the very thing on which all chance of change depends. So back away from teaching, coaching, and reasoning when the child's state is such that they cannot learn. Focus on being present and regulate yourself when you start to feel frustrated, disrespected, or angry because they have not listened to you. If you step away and calm down, you will have access to your cortex to then remember ways to help regulate the child. Your relationship lives to teach another day. Our work with Susan continued for 4 years. She made slow but steady progress. The primary therapeutic techniques evolved from somatosensory to rhythmic and regulatory, including working with a therapy dog, to relational, and finally, to cognitive dominant, like trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, or TFCBT. The fascinating thing is that we ended up using many of the same therapeutic methods that had previously failed. There hadn't been anything inherently wrong with the prior methods. They were simply applied at a time when Susan couldn't benefit from them. Neurosequential. It's all about the sequence. The brain develops, processes incoming sensory input, and heals in sequence. By the end of this therapeutic process, Susan was in a mainstream classroom and on grade level. She had a handful of friends. She had no more explosive or self-mutilation behaviors. She had transitioned to healthier, more socially acceptable forms of dissociative regulation, reading, art, and drama. She was developing her capacity to be kind and compassionate. Her parents were no longer exhausted and burned out.
And the lesson is that no matter what has happened, you get a chance to rewrite the script.
Exactly. It really is never too late. Healing is possible. The key is knowing where to start the process and matching the developmental needs of the person.
I remember talking to Belinda Pittman McGee, who runs the Nia Imani Center in Milwaukee. It's a long-term transitional housing facility for homeless young women who are pregnant or have young children. And Belinda said that women often come to the center with behavioral disorders like quick temper or the inability to hold a job, the kinds of things that come from being raised in a traumatic environment. And when she starts teaching them about trauma, she says they begin to understand that their struggles with emotions and acting out are connected to what happened to them. And that realization in itself can be life-changing when you've labeled yourself as bad or stupid and believed that was your fate.
Exactly. I can't tell you how many people feel incredibly relieved when they get an explanation of how their brain is working and why. We don't give them a psychiatric label. We're just saying this is the way you're organized, and it's absolutely predictable based upon what happened to you. Then we help them understand that the brain is malleable, plastic, changeable. And together, we come up with a plan that will help change some of the systems that appear to be causing them problems.
It's the recognition that what I've been through has caused me to have these kinds of feelings, and I'm not the only one. And it makes sense that if you're an overworked mother of three or four with a history of trauma, You'll have trouble coping while trying to carry your burdens all by yourself. Your health is being compromised in ways you don't even recognize. And then to realize that the reason you feel so overwhelmed is that you haven't found a good way to regulate yourself. This is why giving back to yourself is so important. If you aren't regulated yourself, how can you parent or work effectively?
And that is such an important point. We are often asked to help children and youth who've been maltreated or traumatized or consult for a community following a traumatic event. And when I tell people that I'll actually need to work with the adults too, they're confused. But if the adults who live with, teach, and treat these children are not regulated, they will not be able to be fully present in a compassionate, regulated way. It is those fully present moments that are regulating, rewarding, and healing for the children. If we help the children but don't meet the needs of the adults, our work will have little impact. This is one of the most important principles of any trauma-informed approach. You have to help the frontline adults who will be working with the children and youth. This shift in focus is challenging for some of our systems. In the child mental health system, for example, the patient is the child. The system's economic model typically doesn't include paying a clinician if they want to give time to the child's teacher, coach, or even parents. This is short-sighted. We know that a dysregulated adult cannot regulate a dysregulated child. An exhausted, frustrated, dysregulated adult can't regulate anybody. As you point out, if you don't give back to yourself, you simply will not be effective as a teacher, a leader, a supervisor, a parent, a coach, anything. Self-care is huge. Unfortunately, many people feel some guilt about taking care of themselves. They view self-care as selfish. It's not selfish. It is essential. Remember, the major tool you have in helping others change, whether you are a parent, teacher, coach, therapist, or friend, is you. Relationships are the currency of change.
We have to take care of ourselves. This is especially important considering that so many of us are walking around with trauma or adversity in our own past. I wouldn't be who I am without my trauma. So I own it, I claim it, and by doing that, I believe I found a way to use it in service to others. Empathy, compassion, and forgiveness, these are all part of the practice that moves me forward in every decision or encounter I experience.
And that brings us back to post-traumatic wisdom. When you've lived through adversity, you can come to a point in your life where you can look back, reflect, learn, and grow from the experience. I believe it's hard to understand humankind unless you know a little bit about adversity. Adversity, challenges, disappointment, loss, trauma, all can contribute to the capacity to be broadly empathic, to become wise. Trauma and adversity, in a way, are gifts. What we do with these gifts will differ from person to person.
It's so interesting to hear you say that. When I was growing up, I wanted to live like Leave It to Beaver. That was my idea of what a family should be. Milk and cookies at home, mom and dad together, the whole thing. But I would not have become the evolved human being that I'm still in the process of becoming if I had everything at my disposal or had everything I wanted at exactly the moment I thought I wanted it.
I feel the same way. It is true, though, that the cost of wisdom can be very high. And for many people, the pain never goes away. The wise learn how to carry their burden with grace, often to protect others from the emotional intensity of their pain.
This makes me think again of Anthony Ray Hinton, the man who served those 30 years on death row for a murder he didn't commit. For the first 3 years of his sentence, he did not speak at all. He was so depressed and desolate. He said he felt like God took away his voice. The thing that allowed him to survive was his ability to disassociate. He turned to his imagination and gave himself all kinds of experiences. He played in Wimbledon in his mind, won 5 times, played in the NBA, met the Queen of England. He was married to Halle Berry, and he did it all in his mind.
Amazing. He was able to use his dissociative superpower to protect himself from the uncontrollable, unavoidable pain of his imprisonment.
And then you found a way to turn it to good, the wisdom and grace you're talking about. After he started connecting with the other inmates on death row, he convinced the warden to let them start a book club. He thought they didn't know how to travel in their minds the way he did, but books could let them do that. So he wanted them to have a way to start to heal as he had started to heal. You know, throughout all our many conversations, I keep going back to a show I did with Yolanda Van Zandt years ago. She said that until you heal the wounds of your past, you will continue to bleed. The wounds will bleed through and stain your life through alcohol, through drugs, through sex, through overworking. You have to have the courage to pull out the wound and begin to heal yourself. This is a lesson I hope everyone carries with them from our conversation too. We must understand and heal the wounds of the past before we can fully move forward.
And I can't help thinking the same is true for a society, not just an individual. How can our society move toward a more humane, socially just, creative, and productive future without confronting our collective historical trauma? Both trauma experienced and trauma inflicted. If we truly want to understand ourselves, we need to understand our history, our true history, because the emotional residue of our past follows us.
But that cannot happen until there is a tipping point of awareness of what we've done to ourselves as human beings, of what the true human condition is, of what trauma has done to us. That's when there will be a realization that we need to do something different.
And the core elements are awareness coupled with connectedness. Together, these can create a trauma-informed community.
I think that's what the world truly needs more of right now. When you're able to really see another person, that's true compassion. And extending yourself in compassion to another human being changes the nature of our relationships, our communities, our world. The acknowledgement of one human being by another is what bonds us. Asking, "What happened to you?" expands the human connection.
Yes. It is easy to be discouraged and overwhelmed by the many problems in our society, to be demoralized by the inequities, adversities, and trauma that are all too pervasive in our world. But if you study history, you'll recognize that the overall trajectory for humankind is positive. Our world is filled with so many kind, capable, and creative people. We are a curious species. We will continue to discover, invent, and learn. We can make our world a safer, more just, and humane place for all. Epilogue. The young man was standing waist-deep in the pool, leading an aqua fitness class for the elderly. He was wearing a blue t-shirt with the logo of a retirement home, a lanyard with a whistle, and a large name tag. I couldn't read the name, but I knew it. Jesse, the young man from Chapter 3. The last time I'd seen him, 10 years earlier, he was unconscious in a hospital bed. I watched through a window as Jesse enthusiastically led 8 members of the retirement community through their paces. He moved from person to person, smiling, correcting their stances, gently helping one woman with her shoulder. It was clear that they liked him, and he liked them. He was having fun. They were having fun. He belonged. When I originally evaluated Jesse, it was a consultation for a clinical team in another state. After the initial in-person consultation, which took place while Jesse was still in a coma, I continued to track his progress and consult to his team from a distance. After a month or so, Jesse woke up. Initially, he had signs of severe brain damage, but slowly all of his functioning returned, with the exception of some aspects of his long-term memory, especially narrative memory. His autobiographical memory of life before the coma was in disorganized shards. When asked about people, places, and events, he simply couldn't remember. The neurology team thought this was related to his brain injury. Having seen multiple cases of amnesia following trauma, I wasn't so sure. My recommendation was to let that go for the time being. Let's get him back to walking, talking, moving, socializing. We can track his memory and focus on short-term memory skills. Most important, let's get him into a safe, stable, and nurturing placement for the first time in his life. Initially, Jesse needed a special needs placement due to his rehabilitation plan. The social worker on the team, who was a lot smarter than I, suggested that we place him in a local retirement community that had a continuum of living situations, from independent living condominiums to dorm-like single rooms to more traditional high-needs rehab beds. Several of the community's senior staff members were given on-site housing as part of their compensation. The social worker's partner was one of these staff members. The two of them lived together on campus at the retirement community, and they agreed to foster Jesse. It was a true community, multiple buildings, a garden, a gym with a pool and exercise rooms, a library, hairdresser, several dining rooms, and a coffee shop. The placement was genius. Jesse moved in and immediately was embraced by the staff and residents. Though in the beginning he was homeschooled, within a year he was able to walk down the street to the public school. He was able to manage the academic content. He had no behavioral problems at home or school. But while he made a few friends, he was never very close to or comfortable with his peers. He was liked by all, but not really embraced by any. His best relationships were with his foster parents and the elderly residents. He started working as a transportation aide, helping residents move throughout the complex and get to their various appointments in the community. He learned to drive. At 18, he was allowed to move into one of the independent living placements right next to his foster parents. He graduated from high school. Now, at 23, he was legally independent but connected to his foster parents and considered a part of their family. He was in community college part-time, focusing on physical education classes with aspirations of becoming a physical therapist. At the retirement community, he had advanced to the role of assistant recreation director, with part of his compensation being his housing and board. He had found his safe, stable, and nurturing home. Thousands upon thousands of unstructured therapeutic moments in his community had helped him heal. From time to time, I would hear from my colleagues and get an update. I still wondered about Jesse's memory. He'd had a horrific childhood. Abuse in many forms, along with relational betrayal, neglect, unspeakable degradation. Yet as he recovered from his head injury, he was not impulsive, aggressive, inattentive, or hostile. Although he had physiological reactivity to certain evocative cues, he did not have PTSD or other readily observable trauma-related symptoms. His emotional and behavioral functioning never caused the adult world or him to reach out for mental health help. Dr. Anderson was his neurologist and had been working with Jesse all these years. Knowing that I was coming to town, I'd asked him how Jesse was doing. He suggested I see for myself and asked Jesse if he'd be willing to have lunch with me. "You'll not remember this, Jesse," I said when we met, "but I was one of the doctors working with Dr. Anderson back when you had your brain injury. Thanks for agreeing to see me." He smiled and put his hand out. "Well, thank you for helping me back then." We walked to the cafeteria-style dining room, stood in line to select our lunch, and sat down to talk. Small talk. He asked about Texas. I asked about his school. We went back and forth like that until he asked politely, "Did you come here to analyze me?" I joked back, "No, you'd have to pay me for that." He smiled. We looked at each other, each of us fully present in a silent, connected moment. "I do wonder about your memory, though." A slow sadness came over his face. He gazed down into a space filled with some painful memory. I let the sounds of the cafeteria wash over the moment. An elderly woman came over and kissed Jesse on the forehead. "Thank you for the flowers," she said. "They made my day." The gesture broke his gaze, and the animated, smiling Jesse emerged. "I knew you would like them. Let's go out to the garden this afternoon and get some more." As she walked away, Jesse seemed embarrassed. Not by their interaction, but by the earlier moment of sadness. When you were first recovering from your head injury, Dr. Anderson said you had no memory of your childhood, I offered. Jesse shrugged. I really don't like to think about all that. We don't have to talk about any of this if you don't want to, Jesse. It's okay. I just don't like to think about it. And I don't like to upset anyone. I understand. You probably know that I work with many people, children and adults, who have had terrible life experiences. And each one of them has helped me better understand how to help others. So when you're ready, I would love to learn from you. He studied me as I spoke. You had a really hard start in life, Jesse. And now, here you are. After all you went through, going to school, you have a great job, lots of great relationships, and you seem pretty happy. I suspect you could teach me a lot. I do have trouble sleeping sometimes, I nodded. But then I just get up and work out, go for a run. That really helps. And I get really nervous around too many people. Really just want to go back home whenever I'm out too much. But you're always around people here, Jesse. Yeah, that's true. I mean, I don't really like being around younger people, children. Too loud, too crazy. In that moment, I realized that many of his evocative cues were from the catalog of sensory stimuli from children and childhood. Children's voices, smells, games, cartoons, foods, anything. His childhood was so permeated with threat that his brain, struggling to make sense of the world, associated almost everything in his small abusive world with threat. But his new life, his reset, redo life, was in a world of the elderly. The retirement home was filled with sensory experiences entirely different from those in a class full of children or a group home for youth. The type of movement, the speed of movement, the pitch of voices, the scents, images, schedules, music, television preferences, all were different. Relational interactions were different as well, more parallel and less evocative than those of his childhood. The placement had been even more genius than I'd realized. There were simply far fewer evocative cues to dysregulate Jesse in this setting. He was able to have more moderate, predictable, and controllable experiences here. He had more control over interactions. He pushed people in wheelchairs. They depended on him. Over time, he was able to build a whole new catalog of safe and familiar that provided the foundation for his healing. And the thousands of positive healing interactions over the 10 years of this stable existence built him up. So, the memory loss, I asked. He looked at me with the tiniest of bittersweet smiles. I pretty much remember everything. Yeah, I figured. One of the things I've learned over the years is that what happened to you doesn't just go away. Those childhood experiences can impact you in many ways. And there are ways to help people heal. So if any of your memories ever bother you, or you feel confused or upset, don't hesitate to reach out. There are ways to help make the trauma easier to carry. I gave him my card. After lunch ended, a gaggle of elderly women swept him off to his next exercise session, a modified Zumba class. As he walked down the hall, he looked at my card in his hand, turned to wave, and danced away. We talk a couple of times a year. Jesse's doing just fine. We're both still learning. Dr. Perry.
On November 22nd, 2018, my mother, Vernita Lee, passed away. I was conflicted about our relationship up until the very end. The truth is, it wasn't until I became successful that my mother started to show more interest in me. I wrestled with the question of how to take care of her. What did I owe the woman who gave me life? The Bible says, honor thy father and mother. But what did that actually mean? I decided that one of the ways I could honor her would be to help care for her financially. I always made sure she had everything she needed in order to live a comfortable life, but there was never any real connection. I would say that the audience who watched me on television knew me better than my mother did. When her health began to decline a few years ago, I knew I needed to prepare myself for her transition. Just a few days before Thanksgiving, my sister Patricia called to tell me she thought it was time. I flew to Milwaukee. I sat with my mother for hours in a room. She liked to keep it around 80 degrees, and we watched Steve Harvey's game shows and One Life to Live on a loop. I tried to think of something to say. At one point, I even picked up the manual left by the hospice care people. I read their advice, thinking the whole time how sad it was that I, Oprah Winfrey, who had spoken to thousands of people one-on-one, should have to read a hospice manual to figure out what to say to my mother. When it was finally time to leave, something told me it would be the last time I'd ever see her. But as I turned to go, the words I needed to say still wouldn't come. All I could muster was, "Bye. I'll be seeing you." And I left for, ironically, a speaking engagement. On the flight home the next morning, the little voice in my head suddenly whispered what I knew in my heart to be true. "You are going to regret this. You haven't finished the work." In that moment, I felt like a hypocrite. If anyone else had been in my shoes, I'd have told them, "You need to go back and say the thing that needs to be said." I turned around and went back to Milwaukee. I spent another day in that hot room, and still no words came. That night, I prayed for help. In the morning, I meditated. As I prepared to leave the bedroom, I picked up my phone and noticed the song that was playing, Mahalia Jackson singing "Precious Lord." If ever there was a sign, this was it. I have no idea how Mahalia Jackson appeared on my playlist. As I listened to the words, "Precious Lord, take my hand, lead me home, let me stand. I am tired, I am weak, I am worn. Lead me on through the light, take my hand, precious Lord, and lead me home." I suddenly knew what to do. When I walked into my mother's room, I asked if she wanted to hear the song. She nodded. And then I had another idea. I called my friend Wentley Phipps, a preacher and gospel artist, and asked him to sing "Precious Lord" to my dying mother. Over FaceTime, from his kitchen table, he sang the song a cappella and then prayed that our family would have no fear, just peace. I could see that my mother was moved. The song and the prayer had created a sort of opening for both of us. I began to talk to her about her life, her dreams, and me. Finally, the words were there. I said, "It must have been hard for you not having an education, not having a skill, not knowing what the future held when you became pregnant. I'm sure a lot of people told you to get rid of that baby." She nodded. "But you didn't," I said. "And I want to thank you for keeping this baby." I paused. "I know that many times you didn't know what to do. You did the best you knew how to do. And that's okay with me. That is okay with me. So you can leave now, knowing that it is well It is well with my soul. It's been well for a long time. It was a sacred, beautiful moment, one of the proudest of my life. As an adult, I'd learned to see my mother through a different lens, not as the mother who didn't care for me, protect me, love me, or understand anything about me, but as a young girl, still just a child herself, scared, alone, and unequipped to be a loving parent. I had forgiven my mother years earlier for not being the mother I needed, but she didn't know that. And in our last moments together, I believe I was able to release her from the shame and the guilt of our past. I came back and I finished the work that needed to be done. Forgiveness is giving up the hope that the past could have been any different. But we cannot move forward if we're still holding on to the pain of that past and wishing it was something else. All of us who have been broken and scarred by trauma have the chance to turn those experiences into what Dr. Perry and I have been talking about, post-traumatic wisdom. Forgive yourself. Forgive them. Step out of your history and into the path of your future. My friend, the poet Mark Nepo, says that the pain was necessary in order to know the truth. But we don't have to keep the pain alive in order to keep the truth alive. I made peace with my mother when I stopped comparing her to the mother I wished I had. When I stopped clinging to what should or could have been and turned to what was and what could be. Because what I know for sure is that everything that has happened to you was also happening for you. And all that time, in all of those moments, you were building strength. Strength equals power. What happened to you can be your power.
Thank you for listening to What Happened to You, a Macmillan audio production for Flatiron Books. This program was produced and directed by Guy Oldfield, recorded and engineered by Sal Barone and J.R. Chappell. Post-production by Sal Barone. Text copyright 2021 by Bruce D. Perry, M.D., Ph.D. and Oprah Winfrey. Production copyright 2021 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.